Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And we'll start, before we meet our panel, with a look at the front pages. So, the Sunday Independent is leading with a politician arrested after being found drunk on City Street. Ali Bracken is reporting that a Fine Gael politician was arrested after being found extremely drunk, quotes, on all fours, end quotes, on Dublin's O'Connell Street last month. He was detained on O'Connell Street close to the Gresham Hotel after he was discovered unable to get up due to his level of intoxication. And this was on January 22nd, just hours before the Dáil was forced to disband after a failed attempt to elect Micheál Martin as Taoiseach. Their off-lead is that cracks are starting to appear in the newly formed coalition, with Fine Gael blaming Fianna Fáil and Rose over housing figures and the handling of Storm Éowyn, and also for likening Donald Trump taking over the White House to Brexit. How that is a source of argument, that latter one, I don't know. The Sunday Times: Lowry faces Dáil grilling on link to disgraced tycoon. Michael Lowry is at the centre of a fresh controversy over his past links to a planned language school backed by the late and now discredited businessman Jim Mansfield. And the now discredited is important because Michael Lowry arguing that Jim Mansfield was not discredited at that point. The Business Post is leading with officials call developers to crisis talks after housing target collapse. And they are saying that basically the developers were brought in. Some of them were in for other meetings and were then asked about it. But at one meeting, a developer presented evidence that not a single apartment block funded by private investors had begun construction in the previous 12 months. So the kind of stuff that's been talked about now, and we saw Micheál Martin saying during the week and in the last few days about bringing in more private financing. And I think he mentioned in the Examiner yesterday that everything on the table, including the removal of a cap on rent increases. A lot of these things are going to be politically unpalatable to a lot of people, but clearly there seems to be opinion moving in the direction that we're going to have to do some things that might be unpalatable to some people in order to get financing in for building from the private sector. The Mail on Sunday is leading with OPW spent 50 million on contracts that broke state rules. So these are contracts that failed to comply with state procurement rules on various kind of reasons for that. And the Sunday Mirror is leading with that stabbing to death of a man in Malahide yesterday that you heard about on the news there. The Sunday World is leading with one of the three men connected to raping a young woman, convicted of raping a young woman they met in a Dublin nightclub this week. They're looking at one of them. He's a former Portuguese special ops soldier who's been living in Ireland for a while. And the Sun on Sunday has a very sad story. Megan and Katie Delaney talking about their father, Robert Delaney. Robert Delaney is now 43, right? And he, in 2008, he tried to break up a fight between the wrong people. He was shot. He is now suffering what doctors call a living death. He has no brain function, is confined to a wheelchair, receives permanent care at the brain injury unit in Piemont Hospital in Dublin. And his daughter, Katie, who is 17, says, "I have never heard my father's voice." So very, very sad story. OK, our panel this morning: Mick Clifford is special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Lorna Fitzpatrick is a public affairs account director at Instinctive Partners. Mary Hanafin is a barrister and former Fianna Fáil Minister for Education. And Scott Lucas is professor of US and international politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Brendan.
Mick Clifford, would you take us very carefully through the story that is on the front of the Sunday Independent? And indeed, I didn't mention there is a related story about the same person on the front of the Sunday Times today, this politician.
Yeah, this is an incident that arose, Brendan. In 2020, Fine Gael were conducting a disciplinary investigation into an incident in the course of that, they discovered that there was a separate incident had arisen. This involved a politician and a woman, and inappropriate behaviour was described as. That was then investigated.
In a bar near Leinster House.
That was investigated. The politician apologised. He also, and it's emerged today, he also donated €10,000 to charity just to express his apology or whatever. And that was done. Now, what's additioned today is that the same politician was arrested after he was discovered being intoxicated in O'Connell Street on the day the doll was resumed on 20th of January. And the issue, I suppose, that arises, one particular issue that arises within Fine Gael is the fact that after that first incident, obviously not the second one that happened in January, had been discovered, he was still selected to run an election for Fine Gael, and some people are raising an issue about that.
Okay. And actually, a statement has just this second come in from Senator Martin Conway. And he says, in the early hours of Tuesday, January 22nd, I was arrested by an Garda Síochána on O'Connell Street, Dublin 1, for being in an intoxicated state due to consumption of sleeping tablets and alcohol. I was detained at Store Street Garda Station and subsequently released without charge a number of hours later. This was not disclosed to the party. I would like to apologise unreservedly for this to my family, colleagues, supporters, and my nominating body, Vision Ireland. So he was that is who gave him his nomination.
And should we point out there, Brendan, Martin Conway is somebody who suffers from a visual disability.
I let myself down. I would also like to apologise to the members of An Garda Síochána for having to deal with this matter. I have resigned from the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party. I understand that a disciplinary process will now commence. I kind of feel myself in the light of that we will, let's not discuss that further right now. Okay, so let's move on. There's plenty other party politics in the papers today. Mary Hanafin, you wanted to talk about a piece in the Sunday Independent by Gabia Gatavetskaya, Fianna Fáil Women Defend Gender Balance Efforts. Now, you have been critical of your former leader, Micheál Martin, for his gender balancing of his appointments to cabinet, etc. So now we have these one of the criticisms was that there was this kind of general talk, really, without too many specifics, that women were added to tickets very late, almost as an afterthought. Mm.
Yes, I was critical of the number of women appointed to cabinet on the basis that we reversed rather than going forward. We had 4 women in cabinet, we now have 3. And that is absolutely the wrong way to go. So I think justifiably critical of that. I think the balance was somewhat redressed then when we got to the junior ministers. Fianna Fáil has 7 women elected, which is a pretty paltry number, I have to say. But of those 7, now 4 of them are ministers. So credit where credit is due. And then this week, when the 11 were nominated by the Taoiseach to the Senate, of the 6 Fianna Fáil, 5 were women. So he made great efforts, I have to say, and not only appointing women,
so
but appointing
would you
people
would you
of
kind
great.
Of withdraw your initial criticism at this point? Do you feel that there's been an attempt to right the wrong?
My initial criticism still stands because it referred to cabinet. And cabinet is where it all happens. And if you don't see it, you can't be it. And it's all about recognising women, recognising the voice that they have.
And think some of the women who were made junior ministers could have been made full ministers?
Well, I'm on record as saying I actually thought Mary Butler would have been appointed a cabinet minister. I think she'd be a great chief whip. She has the personality for that. But she would have been also a great cabinet minister. But I think huge efforts have been made since then, both in the junior ministers and in the Senate nominations.
Okay, and to this piece here, these women are saying this criticism of women being added to the ticket late. There are various stories. Some of them not sure if they wanted to run. Some of them were, approached and encouraged to run, but wanted to think about it. One, I think, not well and everything. So, like, we can make general statements, but there does seem to be always.
We can, and Gabby's point is valid, but I mean, women should not feel that they have to take the blame for not being the candidate. Of course, there are individual stories. But yes, it is a genuine criticism that 2 months before an election, which was 5 years in the making, all of the political parties were out there trying to attract women. The time to start is now. the next local elections are not for the guts of 5 years, 4.5 years. The next general election is not till 5 years. Now is the time to start supporting women and placing them in constituencies.
Lorna, you are still a member of the Labour Party,
I am,
correct?
Yeah.
And you were nodding.
No, absolutely agree in terms of the timing of trying to engage and support women to get involved in politics is now. It's not a matter of a couple of weeks before the election, be that local, be that general or whatever the case may be, of trying to scramble and find people to meet quotas and all the rest of it so that you can secure funding. It should absolutely be something that happens day in, day out. And not because of quotas or because we're told it's the right thing to do, because we know having more diverse decision making is more beneficial for all of us. So, you know, whether that's in junior and then I suppose want to support people to within parties to build up that support base in their local communities, then they can put themselves forward for election, run on their merits, run on what they've achieved within their communities, and hopefully we see a greater number of women in the Dáil, in local authorities right across the country, and then we don't necessarily have to be looking to a very small number of women to try and find positions to, or be able to support them to positions within cabinet or junior ministries. We have much more and greater choice.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a quick break. Mick Clifford, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Mary Hanifin and Scott Lucas staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Mick Clifford, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Mary Hanifin and Scott Lucas. And look, I was acting out of an abundance of caution there just in terms of that statement from Martin Conway literally landed in as Mick was outlining that story earlier. I would just say about that statement, so that while Martin Conway has said he is the person involved in that Sunday Independence story of the politician found extremely drunk on O'Connell Street last month, and as he said in the statement there, he has now left the Fine Gael parliamentary party and he apologises profusely to everyone. He has not indicated anything about being the person involved in the other story that was going on all week about politicians, and which is in the Sunday Times today then. And this is about an incident that happened in a bar near Leinster House in the last few years. And the story today being that a politician donated €10,000 to charity as part of the apology. Martin Conway has not indicated anything about that being him in his statement. Lorna, it suddenly becomes kind of a slightly different story now, almost like do you feel a certain human sympathy here?
Yeah, I should say I know Martin. So I've heard this story as we're sitting here on air. As Mick has said, he has a significant vision impairment, and that's how I would have known him, was through previous work and so on. You know, I think he says that it was a mixture of alcohol and sleeping tablets, and that is what was in his statement. Look, I hope that he has he has obviously issued his apologies, and I hope he's given time to be able to do that and engage with any services that he needs to engage with on the back of it. But I think it is quite a surprise for everybody today to see that statement come through and for that to be the front page of the papers.
Yeah, Mick?
Yeah, I think, as Laura said, you know, whether or not it's a fact, you have to take into account the man's disability. I think there's scenarios which arise whereby politicians should be held to account. There are also scenarios that arise whereby human frailty is involved, and that also needs to be taken into account. I think in this country, generally speaking, certainly until recent years, we have a very good record of recognising the difference between those and when either should be applied. And as you said, he's resigned from parliamentary party. There's a process there he's involved in. And, you know, it's not a hanging offence. It's inappropriate what he's described. It looks like there's human frailty involved. Beyond that, it's up to him between himself and his party or whomever, you know.
Yeah. Mary Hanifin, so does Martin Conway have a future in politics?
Until the statement came in, I didn't know it was Martin Conway. I didn't know of the story at all. So I'm actually quite surprised that he issued a statement himself. So I don't know what pressure he came under from his own political party. I've also been an admirer of his over the years, somebody with such a severe disability, the way he was able to cope with the whole political pressure and coming on radio and television and taking briefings, etc., which cannot be easy for him. Politics is also a very difficult profession for anybody who might have a propensity for alcoholism or for drink.
There's no suggestion he's an alcoholic.
No, I'm not saying,
there's a drinking culture around Leinster House, is there still, in reality?
There's a drinking culture still in Ireland in lots of places, yeah. You know, and not amongst younger people, in fairness to them. I think they're much, much more careful. But there's also huge supports and huge help. And so anybody who finds themselves in that situation. But, I mean, Leinster House and political life, late nights, meetings, pubs. I ended up having, for example, some of my clinics in pubs because there was nowhere else. And I don't even drink because there was nowhere else to hold them in areas, you know.
And would I be right in thinking if there's a long day and a long evening going on in Leinster House and in between votes and whatever else, that people do repair for a few drinks over the course of the day or into the Dáil Bar? That's part of the culture, isn't it?
They will repair to where there's company because you don't want to be sitting at your desk all the time. That company is generally in the bar. Now, that's not necessarily to say that you're drinking in the bar, but you are going there for company. So it can lend itself to a culture. As I say, I think people have become much more careful over the years. There's a lot more supports there. And if any politician needs the supports, I think that their colleagues in Leinster House will help them along that way.
OK, and there's a text here from Aidan in Dublin. Brendan, as a person myself with a very significant vision impairment, this disability should never be any mitigation against any behaviour to which other members of society are held to account. And I suppose that's a fair point.
But to be fair, what's involved here, the detail that's in the newspaper suggests it's quite possible.
An inability to get up.
Yeah, it's quite possible that it's disability impinged. I don't know, but I'm just saying I wouldn't discount it.
Scott, are you shocked at this, the level of, like, that this story has come out and this man has now quit his party? Given what we're learning about some of the people in America who are being promoted to the highest office and the various carry-on that they're getting away with, which is off the charts compared to this.
I was trying to keep my native country out of this because of the dysfunction which is happening over there, which is well
which
beyond
we will come to, which yeah, we will come to.
But I think, you know, again, as someone learning about this country, as a recent resident, I think what is interesting is the way that we are negotiating right now in the sense of, all right, there has to be this question of accountability for one's actions, but at the other point of view, this doesn't become like a feeding frenzy to simply attack someone who happens to maybe have transgressed, maybe have done something inappropriate. And I think that's the way to go, that this is a matter for Martin Conway, so it's for his family as well, because there will be a personal story here. And it's a matter in terms of politics where we hope the party acts respectfully but appropriately.
And we are looking for a statement from Fine Gael on this.
And I have to think that the media treatment here as we are navigating it is actually quite refreshing, because I think it would be very different in the United States, that this would become hyperbole rather than, I say, respectful discussion around this.
Okay. Just one quick thing there about Trump. I mean, just parallel with this in a small way. The defense secretary is Pete Hegseth. Yes. I mean, the best statement that came out of him was when there was issues around whether he was drinking. He said he'd stay off the drink while he was the secretary for defense.
He sounds like an Irish guy.
Exactly, that's the thing. I'd stay off while I'm in the job.
Remember your man and Father Ted, the TV presenter? Like, don't give him a drink, whatever you do. One drop of sherry and he wakes up 3 days later. Okay. Listen, there's just one more piece of personality politics, Mary, completely unrelated to this, but you were looking at the Mail on Sunday, John Drennan, today. I think there was a lot of, not quite eyebrows raised or jaws dropped, but people were surprised, not in a bad way, that RTE's Evanny Quillen was in what the Mail are characterising as a midnight raid. But she did, it sounds, obviously there must have been talks going on, but she seems to have resigned from RTE with immediate effect. Like, I'm pretty sure I saw her during the week, during the sports on the 6-1, yeah. which she does. So what do you think of that move into the Shannon for
fair
her?
Fair play to her. I say gorgeous. She has loads of gilga. She's done an awful lot of work on women in sport. She's spoken out on health issues. And I think the Senate, and particularly the Senate 11, gives people the opportunity, or gives the Taoiseach, our leaders, the opportunity to appoint people who would never stand for election, or nothing she won't. But if you look back, People like seriously.
I'd say she will.
Oh, she will, I'm sure. But yeah. Lady Valerie Goulding.
Mary Siri Carney's out in that part of the world as well, isn't she?
She is no longer.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just for a minute, Lady Valerie Goulding was appointed from the Central Medical Clinic. Brian Friel was appointed. Eamon de Butler was appointed to the Senate. Gordon Wilson of OMA, who lost his wife and daughter.
Yeah.
They were all appointed as one of the 11. Eamon Coughlin, to be a voice for an area that is not reflected in the electoral process. And I think she does that quite well. So I'd say well done for appointing her.
OK, let's move on.
That's as much good as I'm going to say about
OK, listen, that's why I'm quitting while we're there on that one. OK, there's lots more to get through and we're a bit behind now. So let's start moving on because there are lots of important issues going on. Lorna, there's a lot of pieces across the papers today about, well, we seem to be assuming that we are, that Micheál Martin is going to be invited mm-hmm. to the White House on Patrick's Day. Let's talk about Alison O'Connor. Sorry to Gaza, but the territory has changed.
Yeah, so this is in the Times. Look, it's a very interesting piece and I think it brings together an awful lot of the kind of talking points that we see across the papers and many other articles today. It calls for, that we're better placed to prioritise release of remaining hostages and increasing humanitarian aid and so on. And that we need to, think of self-preservation at the hands of Trump, who can do Ireland and Ireland Inc., I suppose, great harm.
So what do you reckon? What's the move if we are invited and we get out there? What's the move?
Yeah, so I do think we should go. And I know there are other people who would say that we shouldn't.
I think your party leader has questioned whether...
She has questioned whether it's the appropriate thing to do. Yes, that is true. And whether it's the right thing to do or not. When I think about Trump and I heard Mark Carney and others, the former governor of the Bank of England, who's in the running for the Prime Minister in Canada, say that, Trump's a bully. And you deal with bullies by standing up to bullies, which is the advice my daddy used to give me when I was going to school, that you stand up to bullies. And I think we can do that by going to the White House rather than frailing away from it. But I do think we need to look at this from a big picture and like, what is Trump and Musk and all of them, what are they trying to achieve? You know, when you see what's happening with USAID, I look back at a piece from the UN World Hunger Programme from 2021. And it said that if Elon Musk donated 2% of his net wealth at that time, yeah, he could solve world hunger. And
more
now,
important to put people on Mars, apparently.
Mm-hmm. And now he's chosen to defund USAID. And
yeah. We'll come back to those broader pictures. Scott, you were in DC last week, I think, were you?
Yeah, I was.
Okay. Did you pick up any sense of... I'm not saying that they were all out there talking about us, like, but did you pick up any sense in the circles you were moving in about are we going to be getting an invite? B, this thing we're being told that Americans are becoming increasingly aware that Ireland is, like, in inverted commas, anti-Semitic, or that we are in some way anti-Jewish.
No, it was really interesting event which we had with partners out at Georgetown University about U.S.-Irish relations. And then the Irish Embassy, which was involved in it, lovely reception and dinner. And as you do at receptions and dinners, then you can talk beyond the conference. I think the starting point is that nobody expects Trump to act spitefully and withdraw the invitation or not issue the invitation. I think for months, the embassy, as well as the Department of Foreign Affairs here, have been planning for what would be a Trump presidency. And that approach is to reach out not just to Trump and to flatter him, let's be honest, but to reach out to his advisors. And part of that public diplomacy approach is that you not only get invited to D.C., you give him the photo opportunity, you give him the big shamrock, and that means you haven't antagonized him. Now, with that, you then have the space not only to work within Irish communities, but to work with other countries to respond to key issues like Gaza. So let's take Gaza, for example. When you have this appalling proposal for ethnic cleansing of Gaza, you don't directly kick back against Trump on that, but you work with other countries, remembering that there's an ICJ, an International Court of Justice case over Israeli genocide. There's an ICC case, International Criminal Court case against Benjamin Netanyahu. And of course, there's various questions regarding humanitarian aid and regarding support for Palestine. And that's where you
We have lent our name to one of those cases. We have joined that case. We have also been one of the few countries in Europe, because the others said, you go ahead there. There might have been a sense others would follow, but we have recognized the state of Palestine, right? So we've done that. To be truly moral here, does Micheál Martin need to say something to Trump?
What will be said to the Trump people will be said behind the scenes. It won't be said before the cameras, and it won't be said directly to Trump. You know, he's a transactional politician. Will Ireland be punished for this approach that it's taking? I think, you know, the Israelis will try to stir this up, as they did when Ireland made its intervention with the International Court of Justice case. But I think the thing that's in Alison O'Connor's piece that she's saying openly is that what could be the lightning rod would be the Occupied Territories Bill. Mm-hmm. And the Occupied Territories Bill is going to be at most slow rolled and probably suspended through the Doyle. And that, I think, takes the immediate threat away, because I do think if that bill went through, although I support it, that it would be the type of lightning rod the Israelis would exploit, and that Trump, who doesn't really have a grasp of what's going on, would go after the Irish with possible retribution. Yeah.
Okay, you picked Matt Cooper's piece. Yeah, Matt Cooper has one very straight, simple line in it, that Micheál Martin should be out there representing Ireland and not Palestine.
Yeah, which is very much so. And the only other element that he had included in it is, you know, we've already done the two things that have been referred to here already in terms of recognising Palestine and joining in the case with South Africa at the International Criminal Court of Justice. And he's saying, you know, do we need to go to further with the Occupied Territories Bill? And it's a difficult one. There's no question about it. I mean, do we have basic values? We have not done anything. For example, you look at people like the Uyghurs in China. Okay, that's the other side of the world. We can't relate to that directly, irrespective of obvious human rights abuses there. Palestine people, there is a certain connection there. It seemed it's beyond political parties that Irish people have towards them. What is going on, apart from the devastation of Gaza, is absolutely appalling in the West Bank. And do we make...
It's apparently £1 million worth of trade.
It's symbolic. Right? It's not going to have a practical impact.
Is it Alison O'Connor says, is it going to save one life? Is it going to make any difference? A hill of beans?
Quite possibly not. The only possible way it would make a difference is within the EU. If Ireland does this, are others going to follow? For example, possibly Spain or Norway are the obvious one. That is the only possible. Does it set up a momentum? Does it set up a contrapoint to a different attitude within the EU?
Mary, is there an issue here that we think we can go around taking these moral stances while at the same time like enjoying all the benefits of being economically like the 51st state of America, like, but that we can say what we want about everybody too?
No, I don't think so. I think both diplomatically and politically we are very wise to the way the world has changed. And Scott was talking about the diplomatic offensive that's been going on. That's been going on for the last few years, because there was always a prospect that the Republicans were going to win the presidential election. So contacts have been made. And the team that we have in America, we're now in at least 10 different cities with full diplomatic service and then others around the United States, building up on trade, making contacts and that. And they're working towards the White House politically as well. And I think, and the papers talk about it today, there are some political parties whom you would expect to oppose Ireland going to the White House. But to see the Sock Dems and to see the Labour Party this week questioning whether Ireland should go, I think was really a backward step for them. This is when we need to be united. And I think Gary Murphy put it very well in the Sunday Times, where he says it will be national self-sabotage not to go. That we would insult
agree,
the president,
Lerna?
We would insult millions of Irish heritage, we would insult and not help all of the undocumented. It would be an enormous betrayal of all of those.
And that's why I think we should go. But I also think that it is absolutely reasonable to always ask the question as to whether we should go. And I don't think that's just in light of Trump. I think that's in light of everything. I don't think we should take absolutely anything for granted. wanted, or you know, or just because it has always been done that way, that we should always do it that way. I think we should always assess all of these decisions based on the factors that are in front of us at the moment. But as I say, I do think we should go.
Okay. I mean, there's a difference between whether we should go and whether or not we should support the Occupied Territories Bill. In terms of going, irrespective of who's inside in the White House, they elected their leader. They're perfectly entitled to elect their leader. And our relationship is with the country. So the notion that we wouldn't go on the basis we don't like the occupant of the White House, I think doesn't stand up to scrutiny at all. That's different from the Occupied Territories.
Absolutely.
I actually wonder, never mind Micheál Martin sticking up to Trump, you'd wonder if Trump is going to take some opportunity there to humiliate Micheál Martin or insult him, talk about the way he talks in front of people about, you know, Ireland's got a great thing going on, stealing all our tax money. Me and Micheál are talking about that. And Micheál, I really admire what you guys are doing. You know, that kind of carry on.
But of course, he's also an investor in Ireland. I mean, he likes Ireland. He owned the golf club here. He makes a lot of money here.
Yeah, I don't think that'll happen, Brendan. Let me explain why. And it adds to why I think you need to do the visit. Remember that White House ceremony? You brought in Irish American business leaders. You've got the Irish American Supreme Court justices who are going to be there. You, of course, will have Irish American legislators who are there. It's a big networking event.
Is it still a constituency for Trump, Irish America? Yeah.
Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah, because a lot of Irish Americans have swung to the Republican Party, so he's not going to want to thumb his nose at them.
Okay. Listen, let's swing into more broadly. Look, we all have our opinions, having watched far too much CNN, etc. all week. Scott, watching, I feel like saying sorry for your troubles or something. I mean, I try and stay calm and have equanimity about these things, but this last week has been absolutely insane in your country, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to try, as always, to start with the facts and to start as an analyst and to keep emotion out of it. It's the biggest threat to the U.S. system, and thus possibly to the country, since 1865, which was the end of our Civil War, because it is an attempt by not just Trump, but his advisors, allied with the world's richest men, to take apart the U.S. government, to bypass the legislature, to claim the courts don't have authority, but then to go in and dismantle, and as we've heard, in some cases, eliminate agencies that are doing life-saving work in America and abroad, and to do it by stealing, and I do mean that, stealing millions of records from U.S. agencies, including the Treasury's payment systems, to do so with no regard for the Constitution, to do so with no regard for security clearances, using a group of 19 to 26-year-old men in most cases to just go in and demand the records. And then when officials say you have to follow process to do that, firing those officials. Why are those records being taken? It's to support a purge of thousands of people already, qualified people from the government, to actually paralyze agencies until they can be turned into loyalist encampments.
Okay, when you put it like that, has it some kind of Rubicon, it has felt like things are teetering close to the edge during the last Trump presidency and after it, as we know, the handover and everything. Has some other Rubicon been crossed here? And if this is this on a slippery slope to something really, really bad in terms of American democracy? And but secondly, the courts are still holding the line, are they, so far? And will the courts be complied with?
First, it's not a slippery slope. It's an absolute created avalanche. What has made this different from Trump 1 is that, and this was in plain sight, is that the blueprint for this, which is Project 2025, to take over the agencies using fake wars like the war on diversity and equity and inclusion,
which Trump decried Project 2025 at every available opportunity, claimed not to even have read it, I think, or know anything about it.
He does have a loose relationship with the truth, given that it was members of Trump's inner circle that were in charge of Project 2025, including his new director of the Office of Management and Budget, who, remember, tried to freeze every single American grant and loan, trillions of dollars, when they went into office. They not only knew about it, it got attached to Elon Musk. Because what they could do is within a few days, is just go in with these raids, take the information that they have and put it out in massive disinformation campaigns, again, using the U.S. Agency for International Development as a test case, before the courts could react.
Yeah.
So where are we now, very quickly, to set this up? On Friday, a U.S. District Court came in and said, look, you cannot go into the Treasury and steal the records, and you should destroy copies of what you have. Now, that decision will be appealed, and the question is, will those copies of records be destroyed? But here's the stinger in this tale. Even if that court decision stood, the new Assistant Secretary of Treasury is a man named Tom Krause. Tom Krause is a longtime associate of Elon Musk, who was the man who started the raid on the Treasury documents before he was named to his post. Musk people now have legal positions inside the agencies, which makes it much more difficult for the courts to act against them.
And the courts is the last line here, isn't it? Congress is impotent in this situation. Yep. And if they decide then, which I saw an old clip of Vance last night from a while back, basically saying, if the Supreme Court makes a decision that goes against the President of America, well, then, you know, that's not a legitimate decision, suggesting that. But so if they decide that they are not going to comply with the courts, that's the end, yeah?
It's not the end. You're in a crisis, which is whether Donald Trump or the U.S. system prevails. So I wouldn't be a doomsayer to say there is no response here. There are lots of responses, not only through the courts, but through grassroots organizations at the state and local level. But we should realize that the stakes here are, because some people are just saying, oh, Trump is just maneuvering for compromise. He's thinking outside the box. None of that. Kick that to the curb. The man wants to be an autocrat, and his unelected co-president wants to be an autocrat as well.
Mick. Absolutely agree completely with Scott, but one of the big issues to me is if you look at the most recent attempt, and it was minute compared to what's going on at the moment, you go back to Nixon and Watergate. At that time, you had a very strong media. Media brought down Nixon. You had a very strong Democratic Party that held him to account. You had within the Republicans enough people who realised what was going on. What you have now is a media that has been eviscerated for various reasons. You have a Democratic Party that's all over the shop. There seem to have a certain amount of it is because of their obsession with identity politics, but I think that's overblown completely. But they are in disarray. They don't have any figure to come out and lead them as such. And you have a Democratic Party that is completely cowed. I mean, if you go back to January 6th and everything that happened, initially after that, the likes of Mitchell McConnell and them, they held back from agreeing to the impeachment of Trump because they believed he had no hope of coming back. Well, he has come back. If he had been impeached, he would not be back, and we could be in a different paradigm now. The problem now is as much what's not railed against him as what he's trying to do himself.
Okay. Listen, we move on because I really want to talk about housing, which I think has kind of been reframed as a whole fresh crisis, really, hasn't it, Lorna, at this stage? Like, I mean, we knew there was a crisis, but I think a lot of things have come together in the last few weeks. The fact that we went backwards last year, there have been various reports suggesting that it's not going to get to the kind of numbers it needs. Davies coming out with a massive number. I think that we need 90,000 houses a year, in fact. So, to all that, the Business Post today, you've picked Killian Woods, officials call developers to crisis talks after housing target collapse.
Yeah, so as you say, this is the front page of the Business Post. During these meetings, these crisis meetings that were called by officials in the Department of Housing, they were told by the sectoral bodies and those contractors and representatives of contractors and so on, developers, that there was no sectoral research in midway through last year when the targets were set that would have suggested that we would get to the 40,000 completion figure. Now I know government have cited a number of other different kind of reports and so on that they thought they would get to those figures, but that obviously, as we see, hasn't prevailed. Also, PII, again an IBEC kind of business representative body for this space, have said that the 60,000 commencements this year will not manifest in the completed units by the deadline in 2026 that is set by the funding that they received from the state. They won't meet that deadline, and so yeah, and they're looking for that to be pushed out further.
And I think the property industry is also looking for those charges to be indefinitely got rid of.
Yeah, alongside a number of different things to do with rent caps, and you know they've a long list.
So okay, so as a person who I imagine is probably pro rent caps. Mm-hmm. Are we starting to have to accept that they have hammered the building of new properties and the involvement of private investment, which we need therein?
Well, what I think the Housing Commission came out with very detailed plans around what we needed to do. And there was talk around rent caps in that, but they were different to the rent caps in which we have now. So
you would have a tenant-based rent cap, I think is one idea. Like, do you think that makes sense?
I think that seemed like a reasonable approach put forward by the Housing Commission, absolutely, alongside a number of other things. But I think that the thing is that we can't do any of these in silos. It's not just about taking one piece or, you know, one or two kind of piecemeal, taking a piecemeal approach to this. We need to have a much wider view to it. And one thing that absolutely astounded me from the Business Post piece is, you know, that the government are calling people in now saying, well, why didn't we get there? What do we need to do? What policy do we need for foreign investment in terms of housing? That shouldn't be a surprise. It shouldn't be something that we're just starting to think of now in terms of what policy do we need to have in place to be able to build houses. For Christ's sake, we've been talking about the housing crisis.
But in fairness, I think your party and the left in general have been the ones who've been very much calling these people vulture funds and everything and pushing for them for the draconian stamp duty measures to be taken against them if they tried to buy a property and everything. So we did swing one direction in this. And it does sound now like this is not a belated realisation, but it's a decision that actually we need to swing back in the other way
again,
in terms of private funds.
I don't think it's about swinging one way or the other. I think it's a balanced approach to development, which is what we need. And that's not what we're seeing. And I think the Housing Commission and so on put forward recommendations to allow us to get to that space. But the government ripped them up and didn't do anything with them. And we didn't see them in the programme for government. We didn't see them in Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael's election manifestos either. So, yes, I'm a member of the Labour Party. I do agree with the positions that we had put forward, but in terms of the Land Development Agency and so on. And again, Labour were the only opposition party who didn't, who voted in favour of the Land Development Agency. So we are about being constructive
Mary,
in that position.
Is there, I don't want to call it a fresh panic, is there a fresh impetus suddenly around housing? And does it look as if the Taoiseach himself is actually going to kind of take more of a personal interest and make this his project for his tenure?
I've no doubt the Taoiseach will take a personal interest in it, and he even said it during the week, you know, that it remains the big issue of domestic politics is housing.
Does it need to be coming from the Taoiseach's office, really, to bang heads together for things to happen, to bring people together, to get rid of the kind of piecemeal silo thing?
But I don't accept that there's a piecemeal effort. I mean, all aspects of the policy were looked at, the rent, the private income, the private investment, the state land, all of that was worked on for the last few years. We were all obviously very disappointed. To the end that we exceeded our target if you combine 22, 23 and 24 together. You know, it was last year was the disappointment.
Right, going backwards right now.
No, but
it went backwards last year.
But the figures of the estimate were based on legitimate reports, including Deutsche Bank. And so that obviously was a disappointment. But at the same time, the developers were incentivized to start.
Right? I remember after the third quarter, the figures came out and they were early 20s. And I remember people from the government saying, oh, yeah, but in the last quarter, you'll always get this rush of finishing.
You normally do.
What, you were going to get 20,000 more in the last quarter?
Well, you normally do.
In the event, we barely got to 30.
Yeah, but what also happened last year was that people were incentivized to commence work last year. And we suddenly discovered, or the developers did, they weren't able to commence and finish at the same time.
Everyone knew they weren't going to commence all of those.
They
haven't commenced them. And sure, look, as Lorna just pointed out in the Business Post, they're now saying we need more time to commence the ones we brought in under the Mick.
We also need more private
investment.
It
feels around in circles a lot of the time, doesn't it? Is there a fresh impetus here?
I don't really. There's an attempt at a fresh impetus, but look, this word emergency, that was first. I think there's a resolution in the Dáil around 2017-18. It has not been treated as an emergency. We had an emergency here with COVID. We had a kind of an emergency here with Brexit. Particular things were done during those times.
And the levers can be pulled in emergency.
They can be pulled, but also there has to be a willingness politically for them to be pulled. For instance, issues around rent caps and that, issues around foreign funds, vulture funds, whatever one one wants to call them. These are politically difficult and they have to be grasped. There is most definitely a case, I believe, for an emergency to the extent that you have some kind of a Dáil agreement, not dissimilar to Sláintecéir, as to the best way to go forward and to move it on from there. That is definitely one part. Whether people be amenable to it, I don't know. For example, Sinn Féin's housing document, there's a lot in that that is really, really good and progressive. Why can't that be incorporated into the government's plans as well? Matt Cooper's a very good idea in his column today in terms of in France, I think it is. There's a special savings.
Yeah, floated Barry Andrews. Or
yeah, Barry Andrews floated there. A special savings account, for example, similar to the one they had 20 years ago, that you have it, that you could have a tax-free saving on the basis of all of that money is being invested in housing.
Because we have 100-odd billion sitting in bank
exactly,
accounts.
Exactly, and that's private finance as well as the public finance that has been ramped up. But there's an awful lot. It's multifaceted to the point that a step change is needed and there's no sign as of yet of that coming along.
OK. Listen, just I know that, Mary, you only misspoke there, but Gordon Wilson's daughter, Mary, was killed in Enniskillen and not Oma, but you know, that was a misspeak. We also have a statement from Fine Gael saying Fine Gael notes Senator Martin Conway's statement, apologies and his resignation of the party whip. The matter is now subject to a party disciplinary process. Just before we go to a break, Mick, you picked Eilidh O'Hanlon's piece on the Oma inquiry, which has been very affecting listening to these stories, hasn't it?
It has very much. It's a very interesting column. It's been very affecting. And as she points out, it's one of the few forums where, to a large extent, we're getting to hear victims and the bereaved and what they were put through by elements of the Troubles. She makes the point that the playbook, even though she used that word, for what happened in Oma had been there previously with the Provisional IRA, which this was only 4 months after the Good Friday Agreement. And that, you know, there's an awful lot of scenarios whereby no healing is allowed yet. And people are looking at the past in very different ways in that respect. I think it's a lot of good points in it. And it brings home, once again, that you have various versions of the past being written by interested parties. But when you see what we saw this week, the actual victims coming out, this is the result of what went on. And one can ask at the end, what was it all about?
Yeah, and you think of every other name and every other number of people we hear and every other of these so-called atrocities and you think that each of them has that story of all the people around them affected, the families destroyed and everything. Look, there's a couple more texts saying there, as a visually impaired person myself, I agree with the other visually impaired person. Martin Conway's visual impairment should not be an excuse for behaviour that is unacceptable. To do so feels patronising about disability. But I think in fairness to Mick, what you were saying is that if his actual physical disability in some way affected the state he was in at the time and the position he found himself in. Someone else says, Brendan, if a man has to or is forced to resign because of an episode of intoxication, where does that leave any of us? It's a ridiculously high, hypocritical moral bar to adhere to. And look, there could be a lot more to that story, but absolutely any man of I'm around Martin Conway's age, hands up which one of us hasn't ended up in making a disgrace of ourselves with drink at some stage in our lives, but I suppose time and place as well. Okay, we'll take a break. Mick Clifford, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Mary Hannafin and Scott Lucas staying with us. Welcome back. We're still here, still managing Mick Clifford, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Mary Hannafin and Scott Lucas. Scott, there's an interesting story in the Mail on Sunday today. The sinister story of how an AI deepfake of Pierce Brosnan has left an art gallery owner's world in tatters. And this is not a one-off kind of thing. There was an extraordinary story on Drive Time, I think, last week about this Dublin woman who was convinced by scammers that she was in a relationship with Chris Martin from Coldplay and ended up sending money. So people can't, like it's easy for us to look and think, how could that happen? But clearly they know how to take people in. So what was this Pierce Brosnan one?
We're a long way from when it was just simply a Nigerian prince on email saying he had a fortune to give to you. And in this case, it's the owner of an art gallery in Nottingham in England, Simone Sims. And she thought she was negotiating with Pierce Brosnan
You know, she's got the image of Pierce Brosnan up there. She thinks it's his words that are there.
And they seem to be able to make them appear on Zoom in some weird way. Maybe not talking, but he was there seeming to.
He was there. Yeah. And, you know, and again, the ability to manipulate sound and audio alongside the picture that she thinks she's communicating with him to appear at an exhibition at her art gallery. She pays an appearance fee, clearly, for him to appear, sells all these tickets to the exhibition, and then it's not Pierce Brosnan. You mentioned the Chris Martin case. There's a case of a French woman who thought she was in a relationship with Brad Pitt. Part of this has to do with the advance of technology and that so much of our lives are conducted virtually and conducted in distance. And part of it's just the very, very human story of people wanting to believe that something very good is going to happen in their lives. And so the technology side of the story, I think, will be covered again and again and again. I think it's the other side of the story that I'm really, really interested in, which is how can you give support to people? How can you work with people who may be emotionally vulnerable, where they don't fall prey to this, or if they fall prey to this, they don't just become an object of spectacle, which is what is happening here, to be honest with you. But yeah. Actually, look, you got to reach out and help folks like this, because beyond stories like this, there will be others that will not get reported. And I think what's especially probably to me is younger people, you know, that whole world we grew up in what's now the dark ages for me, but younger people who may be catfished online, who may be groomed online, that is going to be a serious issue.
And it's only getting more and more sophisticated, basically. Yeah. Okay. And from that to your song, Lorna.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Did the right woman win?
I think so. Look, are we going to win the Eurovision? I don't know. But it is an absolute bop. And if anybody hasn't heard Emmy's song, I had a great time watching the show on Friday evening and going through them. In fairness, they were all very good. Loved seeing Samantha Mumba and, you know, bringing me back to those days too. But the song, I think Emmy's song is fantastic. It's obviously about Laika, the dog that went to space. But it's a very nice end to that tale and how we're all having a party in the sky.
Mary, it's a long way from Hold Me Now, isn't it? And I suppose Terminal 3 Flights on Time, Linda Martin's one, I think written also by Johnny Logan, that kind of did delve into aeronauticals in general, but we've gone into the stratosphere now with Laika.
Whatever, you know. I mean, although I do have to say, given all of the Irish talents that we have with Irish songwriters and Irish singers, the idea of Ireland sending a Norwegian singer, albeit with a good song, to represent us in the Eurovision, I think, is a bit of a slap in the face
Irish
for a lot of the Irish. You know.
And it is the song.
I know, one of five, but I mean, we've had such great success. I think it's Norway's revenge.
Five is the minimum it takes a song to write a song these days. Like, you look at some of the stuff, there's about 20 writers on songs.
Can I just say the one, Pierce Brosnan, was at the IFTAs one year, the Film Awards television, absolutely packed, and Pierce Brosnan came in at the front. He didn't walk in, he glided in.
Yeah.
And there was this hush from every woman in the audience. Now, I'm not saying I'd be duped by him, but I can see how people were definitely taken with them.
Okay. Scott, did you watch Eurovision?
I have a connection to Laika Party, right?
Right.
I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, which the center of the space and rocket industry. And when I was a kid, we sent two monkeys into space. Miss Baker lived to an old age. She was in her enclosure in the National Space and Rocket Center.
Alive.
Alive. Still there, still getting fed, still quite cheerful. Because for us was, in the Cold War, the Russians let their doggy die, Laika. We made sure our monkeys lived. So I welcome back the spirit of Laika.
Okay, so I would make 2 points to you there on that. There is now seems to be a question mark over whether Laika did die. Laika is apparently partying in space, possibly. Am I right, Lorna?
According to Emmy.
And secondly, I did a quick Google there. I never knew about this monkeys in space. He killed a fair few monkeys in space as well for the ones that lived. Who knew there was a rich history of monkeys going into space?
Like I said, in Alabama, we got few things to cling on to. But Miss okay. Baker, the space monkey, that one's ours.
Okay, and that's as good a note as any to end on. Thank you so much to my panel this morning. Mick Clifford, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Mary Hannafin and Scott Lucas. And now it's 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom and Helen Donoghue.